and bypass the public hearing on Senate Bill 390. And the reason I'm doing that is that the companion bill in the House is scheduled to pass out of committee Wednesday, and it will have the wordings of the amendment that was drafted for Senate Bill 390. And I wish to make sure that we have an opportunity to pass something that doesn't get tied up with a bunch of other things like it did 2 years ago, and wind up and we get nothing to help those that wind up in a tragic situation because of the death of a husband or a father or whatever the case might be, with and not being able to continue an organized a dental practice until the estate is able to be settled. So I'm going to open a public work session on Senate Bill 390.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 390 to the floor of the House for the defense recommendation.
Senator Morissette moves Senate Bill 390 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Floor of the Senate. I'd like to amend my amendment to say, my motion to say the Senate instead of the House.
Since I started to introduce the committee in the wrong terminology, I'll accept that, Senator Morissette. Some habits are hard to break. Further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll? Senator Starr is excused. He's in a committee testifying on another bill.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Florno?
Aye.
Senator Starr? Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. I will carry the bill. Close the work session on Senate Bill 390. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 865, and I'll ask staff to introduce the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 865 directs the Department of Human Services to seek a waiver to deny eligibility for medical assistance to otherwise eligible applicants receiving or eligible for other health care benefits from the Veterans Health Administration or from an employer-sponsored plan. That is the printed bill. However, you have a dash 2 amendment, which revises the bill and requires the Department of Human Services to establish a third-party payer system and requires the department to establish a committee to assist and advise the department in obtaining a contract for that third-party system, and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2003, and this currently has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Gee, what's that if we... What you got if we... Okay. And we do have amendments for that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that was the dash 2 that I just mentioned.
Has that been out for enough time that folks have had a chance to?
Actually, we just received that on Friday. But we did get it to John Root, who worked with us on some...
Okay, but very likely some of the others have not had a chance to see that. So I'm going to make just a little explanation in this. At the 11th hour of the opportunity to put in Senate bills, I still wasn't decided on this particular bill, and so we had to have special dispensation to get this made by Rules Committee. And in the speed with which it was drafted, it didn't exactly come out like it was intended. And so there is a dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 865. Is there copies on the table?
Yes.
I believe there's copies on the table. Now, I realize that there are several groups here probably that have not had a chance to, and individuals that have come that have not had a chance to see and study out through this dash 2 amendment, but basically the intent of this public hearing today is to actually work on the dash 2 amendments. There could potentially be a dash 3 amendment in the making that would add to it, but we'll take that as it comes, and it's not available at this point in time. So I'm going to ask John Root, Adam Grad, and Ed Eagles to come forward and testify on Senate Bill 865.
Sanders?
John, go ahead in whatever order you want.
Okay, we're going to Adam Grant or Gander.
All right.
Is going to present the amendment.
Go ahead, Adam. Introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Senators, my name is Adam Grad. I'm here with Ed Eagles and John Root. They work with me in a company called Digital Healthcare. Our company is the sole U.S. licensee of various patent claims on business processes in the healthcare finance, one of which is a core issue of the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 865, the automation of coordination of benefits. Because of the 14-year background our firm has in automating this paper insurance procedure, we have an unusual degree of expertise in this arcane area. We've been active with Idaho Medicaid and the Idaho Assembly and have begun work with Washington State on a process very similar to that which we are gathered here today. We have colleagues throughout the United States who are also pursuing the same situations. We are scheduled to testify in the House Veterans Affairs Committee in Washington about the use of our technology on May 7th. Oregon, like all other states, has a budget crisis that is impinging on many worthwhile programs. Senate Bill 865, you have devised a means of cutting into this deficit. Under federal regulations, Oregon Medicaid is required to conduct a third-party liability program. Third-party liability and coordination of benefits are virtually the same thing. Most states contract this work out. Oregon conducts this program with its own employees. The third-party liability program, as mandated in federal law, is inherently inefficient. The program takes claims that have already been paid out and laboriously matches the identities of the patients to other sources of insurance. Then the program then seeks to indemnity from those private sector insurance plans, which by law is always primary. In the trade, this is called the pay-and-chase method. The inefficiencies of this system are several. First, a drain put on the Treasury for funds that may later be recovered. Obviously, it would be better if the deficit if those funds never left the checkbook. Second, time value of those funds is permanently lost. Third, in the majority of states, 80% or more of the claims that are found have primary coverage elsewhere, and they're abandoned. This is because the average 15% contingency fee the vendors charge on the average $600 claim is only a 90% payout for that company before collection costs. And there is a risk of not collecting at all. Old-fashioned pay-and-chase, COB, is just not profitable on most claims. Fourth, federal financial support for the old pay-and-chase method is lower than federal financial support on automation, and automation is less labor-intensive. Since our first patent filing in 1993, Digital Healthcare has been advancing the idea of automating this search for primary coverage on a claim as it passes in electronic commerce from the doctor or hospital to the insurance community. If such a process were in place in Oregon, there would be no claims paid that needed to be chased. The idea of conducting online, real-time, preemptive coordination of benefits has been endorsed by the U.S. Office of Management and Budget in testimony before the U.S. Senate in 1995, and by the Work Group on Electronic Data Interchange, the parent of HIPAA, in 1993. Wishes to say, ladies and gentlemen, that the amendment to Senate Bill 865 is consistent with opinions of professionals among the federal authorities who fund 60% of the claims of the Oregon Health Plan, and with the trade associations for our hospitals and insurers, and with the Medicaid regulators. In the amendment to Bill 865, the Senate is supporting modernization of an old-fashioned paper process. As experts in this subject, we applaud the amendment for the good of Oregon Health Plan beneficiaries, for the fiscal integrity of the OHP fund, and for the good of the state budget. There may be vested interests that oppose this upgrade. In some states, we have found that Medicaid fiscal intermediaries are paid by the number of claims processed, which hardly creates an incentive to reduce the number of claims. In other cases, we have found that state employees have grown comfortable with the vendor or internal pay and chase method and have not seen a need to look for opportunities to improve in this area. Therefore, it is important that the Assembly provide leadership on this point. Oregon Medicaid is required to file a report with the federal government every quarter called the CMS Form 64 to report on its progress with third-party liability. In the most recent reporting year, published on the federal website, Oregon Medicaid's CMS 64 says that it spent $2.6 billion on Medicaid claims and recovered only $6 million. From third-party liability, or about 0.23%, 23 hundredths of 1%. This is not a very good result when compared with other state Medicaid authorities. Even commercial payers, who unlike Medicaid are not always secondary, get a much better result, averaging 2-3% of paid claims by doing COB by hand. Medicaid authorities fail at COB because the most popular vendors search fewer than 100 payers in a constellation of over 4,000. They do so retrospectively and are paid on contingencies. Automation has none of these defects. The primary mission of automated COB is to deliver the claim to the right primary payer in the first place. Whoever that may be, however large or small the claim may be, it's really more like a switchboard at the phone company that routes your call to the right destination. Under HIPAA, a computer can scan all 4,000 payers' eligibility files for coverage. With our patents, that computer can calculate the primacy of the other plan, and since in our model, the job of the computer is not to recover old claims, but to route live claims on their way to payment, not even the smallest claim will be abandoned. Medicaid COB results are especially deplorable considering what is available out there. Digital Healthcare has conducted the first audited examination of the completeness of the old-fashioned COB method in a national COB cost analysis. Six state authorities, not including Oregon, participated in that process. We found that undiscovered COB events average 20% of the Medicaid-insured population. I've attached two of these reports to the auditor's statement and the auditor's statement to the testimony document before you. Oregon Medicaid is not very transparent on the subject of how it carries on its third-party liability program. So it could be that the poor results are not due to inefficient TPL methods, but because the population of Oregon is somehow differs from the other jurisdictions. This seems unlikely to us. The gap between the audited examination of other states and Oregon's Medicaid COB results at 0.23% implies that Oregon Health Plan is probably paying more claims than it would be if it automated the problem out of existence, possibly as much as $200 million per year. Another participant in the cost analysis was Oregon's own Providence Health System. Their report is also attached to the testimony document. Providence is a highly reputable organization. We have found that hospitals as far away as Texas send new employees here to be trained on this patient admitting and billing function. Nevertheless, the national cost analysis showed that Providence inadvertently billed the wrong payer 18% of the time. Some of the time, this was Oregon Health Plan. My colleagues and I have been to a lot of hospitals and think there's another good result that amended Senate Bill 865 will produce. Our medical providers, too, today waste a fabulous amount of time and therefore overhead expense trying to do this coordination of benefits task by hand. And the evidence at Providence shows that it doesn't even work. Automating COB will make the admitting and billing process faster, easier for our families and for our medical providers, and it will cut into the rising medical costs, at least in the form of overhead. Overhead is a part of every bill that Oregon Health Plan pays. We have done some research that indicates automated COB will cut the cost of an inpatient admission from $75 down to $18, and even deeper economic discounts can occur in outpatient settings. There's another factor that we'd like to draw your attention to. The U.S. government compensates Oregon Medicaid for 50% of its administrative expenses and 60% of its claims, but the federal government pays for 90% of a start-up phase of a new information system and 75% for the ongoing basis. So the automated system is less costly in absolute terms than the claims it prevents, and the Oregon Treasury carries a smaller part of the burden. Oregon did not participate in the national COB cost analysis, and the future is not wholly predictable, so we cannot guarantee the Senate how much Medicaid's budget will be saved rather than spent as a result of automating COB. But we can guarantee that no claim will reach Medicaid's inbox that belongs to another insurance plan. Senate Bill 865 guarantees the fiscal integrity of Medicaid. Let's consider the impact on our hospitals and other medical providers. Each of these providers is now working towards electronic commerce under HIPAA. Most of these providers think of Medicaid as their largest customer. As a result, we are often told by medical providers that they will wait for Medicaid policy before settling on a new way of doing business. Senators, we heard this as recently as last Thursday from the public hospitals in the state of New York. Medicaid needs to lead the provider community in the deployment of automated COB. This is remarkably easy. It is important that Oregon Medicaid notify the provider community that the inbox for claims is a server address that will conduct COB at that note, and that notice should go out before irreplaceable budget dollars are expended on systems that cannot do this for all parties concerned. The Senate may be concerned about providers' reaction to this new method. As a part of the testimony package, I have included an email message received by our chief of staff from the director of medical operations at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation, one of the largest freestanding hospitals in the country. In this message, the director says that the proposal before you is a quantum leap from the system available to him now, and that he plans to do his best to smooth the process of its installation. This is the personal opinion of a professional in the field, not necessarily an official opinion of his employer. But it makes the point that once providers are educated on the system, they will appreciate the Senate's initiative in this direction. On Friday of last week, our Director of Government Subscriber Relations got a very similar statement from the Chief of Patient Care and Administrative Services at one of the largest Veterans Administration hospitals in the country. We are concerned that the state of Oregon communicate with the providers and payer community on this technology with enough lead time before HIPAA Day on October 16th to allow the orderly implementation of compliance. To aid in this, we've added an additional section to Senate Bill 865 to help in the implementation of compliance. In conclusion, my colleagues and I have had the privilege of reading amended Senate Bill 865 before today's hearing. And as experts in the operation of health benefit plans and automated e-commerce systems, we concur with the authors of the bill that these steps will improve the operating efficiency of Medicaid and the provider community, and also very likely reduce the state budget deficit. Senator, this concludes my comments. I remit the rest of my time for questions.
Yes, Senator Morissette. Okay.
A Okay, going back to the paragraph, well, you don't have your pages numbered, but the factor, the U.S. government compensates Oregon Medicaid by, for 50% of its admitted expenses. Federal government pays 90% of the startup phase of a new information system and 75% of the ongoing cost.
Correct.
Okay, now, it's somewhere else you mentioned the potential saving to Oregon. Is that in the...
The potential savings comes from two areas. One is the avoided claims. What we're saying is we will make sure that no claims that belong to another insurance plan come to Oregon Medicaid. They currently are. You are currently doing pay and chase. And on those claims, you are not finding them all. And we will make sure the correct claims go to the correct payer down to $1. It does not matter the size of the claim because we are doing preemptive coordination of benefit. We're routing it before it comes to you.
The other question was with the private sector, and what advantage to the private sector is there that we do this? If we do this, then that allows them to
very simply
add on to it, or go ahead.
No, very simply, if the state, being their largest customer, implements this and they follow along, they will, number one, be paid quicker. That's just dealing with you as a customer. For them, it will reduce their cost for admittance. Currently, 46% of patients that walk into the doctor's office, emergency room, hospital.
Yeah, well, my question is, how much is it going to cost them, if anything?
They will cost them $1 per outpatient billing. In other words, if you walk in, you present your card, and you have an outpatient service done, that's $1. If it's an inpatient and they're in the hospital, it will cost $3 per day for a maximum of 6 days for a total bill from us of $18.
Okay, so if we set up the system, then they can just kind of tag on to it and they would pay.
Correct.
Okay.
They will get the benefit whether they are on the system or not when they're billing Oregon Medicaid.
Okay, now, the six states, I think I see several of them.
We didn't provide all six states.
It lists five, I think, maybe four. Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, Texas? No.
No, I don't think Texas is in there. I believe Wyoming is in there. Vermont. Can't rattle them off the top of my head. My apologies.
Okay. Well, are they listed somewhere?
West Virginia, Iowa.
Idaho. Idaho is not one of them.
No. Iowa. Okay. Has there been a partnership in other states in implementing this between the public sector and the private sector because they both benefit? In other words, have they been willing to pay something to get the thing going along with?
Well, it hasn't started up as of yet because HIPAA Day hasn't arrived. Most of the contracts that we have pending will start rollout on July 1st. Until the gateways are open on October 16th, we are not going to be able to query those other insurance companies.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the concept. That right now, I'll use a state like Idaho, as I have great knowledge of that in reference. When Idaho has their vendor go out and look at TPL claims, third-party liability, that vendor searches 73 payers. Well, there's 4,000 payers in the United States, so they have not done a thorough job. We will query on every claim that comes out all 4,000 payers and make sure it goes to the correct insurance company.
One other question.
Senator Moore,
what took you so long to get this to us? I mean, we just got it a few minutes ago.
Well, if you remember, I came out and visited you a month,
you
month
did.
And a half ago.
You did.
That was the beginning. We had time for rollout, just kind of working with it, and we were kind of stagnated in getting anywhere. That's why I came to the legislature for help in doing this, and you guys have responded phenomenally well. And we've changed our practices in other states. We're avoiding Medicaid and going straight to the legislature.
Now, you gave me that little three-ring binder, did you?
Correct.
Yeah.
There's substantially more information than that.
Yeah. And I did look at it, look through it, but then it kind of...
Is that all? I mean, you have nothing else to do, correct?
No.
No, I'm good.
Well, it sounds good. That's all I have. Questions.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll be around if you have any questions afterwards.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's going to be some more work done on this before we're through, so look forward to trying to do this the best way we can.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jacqueline Zimmer and Jeff Hill. Shouldn't have signed up so early on the list.
No, not necessarily that.
Mm-hmm. We're patient.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I do have one other thing for you. I'm terribly sorry.
Yeah, they made that presentation. You were busy doing something else.
Well, you? I talked with them individually for a while. And, I did give them a note for
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones. I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And with me today is Jeff Hill from Washington County Aging and Veterans Services. He is a county veteran services officer up there, and I think the certified smart person on the issue of county veteran services officers. And the reason that we come to you today is that we had a, by background, we had a budget note during the last biennium. It was sort of a kind of, at the end of session, we promoted the idea of asking the county veteran services officers in Multnomah and Washington County to establish a pilot program to go out and really help divert veterans who are coming into the state Medicaid system, help them navigate the VA, help them fight denial of benefits, and then to also look in the existing caseload for people who might be eligible for veterans benefits but weren't aware of it. And so what they did was in these two counties sort of was a with the cooperation of the SPD was to work for was it about 9 months on this pilot program. So let me explain a couple of things that you have in front of you, and then I'm going to turn this over as well to Jeff so he can explain to you a little more about how it works. But this, you have a document in front of you. Does it looks like this, and on the front of it you can see in handwriting that after the initial startup costs that this program in these two pilot programs or in these two pilot communities generated over $350,000 in savings to the state of Oregon by way of diverting those clients and recovering benefits for veterans. That program, by the way, was sort of abruptly ended by the emergency board in, it was either October or November.
November 30th.
When November 30th, things started getting really tight around here, and that was a program ended, even though there was not a recommendation to end it at that time. The other reason that we're here today is that we thought that what the state ought to consider is going ahead with a pilot program in areas of the state where there's a high concentration of veterans to help
see if we can't recover funding in those areas as well. And so we created Senate Bill 36, House Bill 3609, which has a hearing in, on this coming Thursday, we just learned. And that bill would make the pilot program in Multnomah, Washington, and Lane counties. That would really establish that and not make it sort of a middle-of-the-night budget note program, but would in fact set it up so that it is on the books and that there's some funding generated for it. And subsequent to that, we looked at the state, and that this is the other piece I'm speaking about right now. It says a veterans pilot option, new approach regarding Senate Bill 865. This particular document shows you eight counties in the state of Oregon and their veteran population. And just in these eight counties, you can see there are 235,754 veterans. And what's been happening historically in the state of Oregon is that there is $10,000 given, isn't it per year, per biennium?
A maximum of
$12,500 per year to 34
Correct.
County veteran services officers around the state of Oregon to help veterans navigate benefits. And if you've ever had to apply for veterans benefits, you're not having a very good day. The application process is not user-friendly. It's overwhelming. And oftentimes the first response out of the VA is no. That's a great way of saving money if you're running the VA. But and these folks need help navigating this. And these county veteran services officers earn, by general government funding, the equivalent of a quarter position to help all of the vets in their community. So if you just look at these eight counties, you can see that actually totals, you know, I mean, I just haven't done the math, but that's like four county veteran services officers for 235,000 people. It's just not enough. And the goal is really, again, to divert people from Medicaid in the first place and to help them navigate and to help them then recover, because what happens is once you are declared eligible by the Veterans Administration for benefits, they go back to your point of eligibility. And some folks receive substantial sums of money for the time that they've been eligible and have either didn't know it or were battling the system to grasp their funding. The catch is that they're not mandated to repay the state for services that the state provided to them during their time. So to move to a system where we pump up that County Veteran Services Officer program and help recover more money, the savings on this piece of paper, I might have said $354,000, but think about how much that adds up to if you consider that veteran, maybe we caught them at age 72 and they live to 99. I mean, they might have been on the state Medicaid system for another 25 years. Or another 20 years. So there's savings that you can't even sort of fathom when you look to moving somebody onto benefits that they really are entitled to. Now, the interesting thing about the folks before us, Mr. Grad's testimony, is that an automated system doesn't help the veteran, in this case the veteran, access their benefits. It just says no. And then the veteran is still left needing somebody to help them navigate the system until the system says yes. And we have case managers throughout our system, but again, the training to become a County Veteran Services Officer is so intense. I think it's about over a two-year period you have to go through training that you don't want to train all of your case managers to know all of the ins and outs of the veterans program. So the County Veteran Services Officers really become a highly specialized tool for recovering money and helping our own Oregonians. So I think there's just a little piece missing, unless I didn't hear it, is that this automated system, I'm not sure that it actually helps the client. get the services that they need. I think it just denies them.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Jacqueline. You're saying you don't know if it helps the client, but are you saying that it does hurt the client, though? You're saying that once they say no, then the client is stymied? I don't understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, it would take a little more conversation with these folks whom I did not know until today, but they probably didn't know about me either. But it sounds to me like their task is to simply tell people, veterans or others, no. And to stop them from getting any benefits that they may not be entitled to. So when someone comes to us as a state and asks for state Medicaid services, we give it to them, and when we deem that they're eligible for something else, we help them. The goal is to help them navigate and get those benefits and get them off of the state system. So I'm not sure that their system takes care of people the way ours does.
Okay. Well, I guess my question, are they mutually exclusive?
I think they're actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, I can't say for sure. I think they're mutually exclusive. I think that they are doing what the County Veteran Services officers probably could do if we actually funded them adequately. So, and then I'll turn, if there's no more questions for me, I'll turn it over to Jeff. I hadn't already said it all.
Sorry.
You could talk a little bit about that, then.
Okay, I can answer questions on either the two programs. What we really wanted to get before you was the... my name is Jeff Hill with Washington County Aging and Veteran Services. What we wanted to do was get before you an amendment possibly for Senate Bill 865 and a way to fund veterans county service officers to assist individuals to move them off of Medicaid benefits or at least reduce the cost of the Medicaid program by obtaining federal VA benefits for them. The one before you, basically what we're looking at is in the eight counties that are listed there that have at least 12,000 veterans or more per county, is funding a veteran service officer in those counties to exclusively work with the Department of Senior and People with Disabilities to move these veterans, identify and move these veterans and their widows into the Veterans Administration programs, either eliminating or reducing the costs to the Medicaid program within the state, and at the same time, any retroactive payments, recovering those for the state for services that they rendered prior to the veteran receiving the veteran's benefits.
What type of recovery do you get from the Veterans Administration?
It depends on how long the claim is pending. As Jacqueline indicated earlier, that when the VA, from the date of claim to the date that the VA makes their final decision, that time period is there's a retroactive payment, and it can be anywhere, normally about averages about $6,000 to $8,000 per client.
How far back does that go?
It can take the veterans up to 9 to 12 months to make a claim on, or a decision on a pension claim for them. It could take longer for a service-connected claim, a year or longer.
But if you get reimbursed for your care, how far back does that go?
To the date of claim, to the date they filed their paperwork.
For the VA benefit?
Correct.
So you get basically nothing and no credit until you ferret that out?
While the claim is pending, they get nothing. Once the VA makes a decision, then they're retroactively paid back to that date of claim the full amount that they would have received for that time period.
And Senator Fisher, if I might add, that money goes directly to the client. It does not need to go to the state. The state does not get reimbursed for any money that they have spent. So the urgency to have County Veteran Services officers funded and functioning at a high level is strong, because the better the opportunity they have to recover those funds on behalf of the veteran, the less money the state is spending on these, spending out of their own pocket for folks. And my understanding is, and I just, Elizabeth Lopez explained this to me, is that it's a federal law that keeps us from forcing people to pay the state back any of their Medicaid.
It doesn't require them, but it doesn't prevent them from paying it back. The state can make the request. But the veteran has the option not to. He can go off of the Medicaid benefits once they receive their veteran's benefit. And they don't have to pay the state back.
Okay. Further questions?
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Hoopman, Dennis Hoopman, Greg Warnock, and Walter Cruz.
Greg Warnock.
Who signs his name?
He did plan on coming, and I'm not sure why he's not here. I had spoken with him yesterday. He had prepared testimony, and he was going to be down here. He just didn't show. I put his name on. He didn't put mine on before we come.
We'll send the state police out to find him. How's that?
Pardon?
We'll send the state police out to find him.
I will do a better job. I know where he works.
Go ahead, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Walter Cruz. I'm the legislative representative for the Noncommissioned Officers Association, and I'm the current chairman for the United Veterans Groups of Oregon. At the meeting last Saturday, the UVGO voted to oppose this bill in as much as its reference to veterans. The Dash 2 amendment we have no quarrel with at this point. But
I assured your representatives that came and talked with me that it was not my intent to exclude veterans, that we would be amending the bill, which we've done, and
yeah.
I apologize you didn't have a little more chance to work on it, but our people here have been working overnight and then weekends to get our bills and amendments drafted, and we're admittedly a little bit behind the scenes here.
Right.
Yeah.
We just don't want any discrimination as far as veterans are concerned, because a lot of times with veterans, you say, well, they're veterans, they can get in the VA hospital. That's not always true. The federal plans now are to cut $25 million over the next 10 years from the VA budgets. And a veteran cannot always get into the VA hospital or medical system. And so they sometimes have to rely on the state or whatever else is available to them.
Yeah, I'm a veteran and I have no veterans medical benefits, so I understand exactly what you're coming from.
But the NCOA and the United Veterans Groups of Oregon are against the original bill, but we can live with the amendment.
Okay. Senator Morse.
But you're okay with the bill with the amendments, is that what you're saying? Because
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Well, the amendments basically replace the bill.
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, other distinguished members, my name is Dennis Hoyman. I was the person who signed up Mr. Warnock, and I could speak for him on the very original bill. He opposed it also the way it was written, and so did I, and that's why I'm here. I did not see the Dash 2 amendments until a little while ago, and I would have to agree at this point I don't see any problem with it, but as Mr. Cruz here does state, health care in the veterans system is not an automatic. In my particular case, it took me over 13 years to get my benefits established through the Veterans Hospital. At this particular point, I have a problem with my right wrist. This has been going on for 18 months. I still haven't gotten my appointments to do anything through the hospital here, so I'm doing it on care outside the hospital until the VA can do the major fix or whatever they have to do. But as these bill stands here as dash two on the surface, it looks as though I could live with this right here.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that, and I again apologize that we weren't able to get these amendments out, but they're pushing us to close our committees, and so we're trying to do as much as we can here as quickly as possible.
Yes, Chair Fisher, I've been here, I've seen this.
I would have to say that you guys both would have to fight over the top of me to vote against 865 the way it is originally written, so we have no intentions of furthering that particular language, so thank you so much for being here. And incidentally, when you get a chance to look it over, if you would confer with Ms. Taylor here, our staff administrator, and you can get her address and phone number and stuff here. We'd certainly appreciate your input because we will, I'm sure, be looking at other amendments, and we're trying to coordinate some things with some of the House members that are wanting to weigh in on this also. So there will be quite a bit of work to do yet. And we may not get it all done in the Senate. We may have to be even finish some of it up in the House. So we'd like to offer you that opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, gentlemen, both. Maybe Greg was smarter than you guys. He read between the lines.
I don't blame him.
Saved himself a trip to Salem.
Greg Warnock always seems to have the information before I do.
Joan Kapowicz and Elizabeth Lopez.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joan Kapowicz. I'm from the Department of Human Services. And I'm here with Elizabeth Lopez, also with the Department of Human Services. When we came over, we hadn't had a chance to see the Dash 2 amendments, but we did want to make a couple comments and potentially answer any questions you might have to the best of our ability. First off, I'd like to start with the fact that the federal government does, in fact, strongly endorse cost avoidance. And so they require that the state has something called pay and chase waivers if they are to do pay and chase. Currently, the state of Oregon does have a pay and chase waiver for pharmacy services. And I believe we have one other small pay and chase waiver. It's just for some services that aren't ordinarily offered by other insurance companies. And the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid are very careful about those waivers because they don't want to encourage pay and chase. We did inform the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid last year that we intended to give back our pharmacy pay and chase waiver because we were updating our First Health system so that it would take the information that the clients report to us when they come on to the plan and send that electronically to the first carrier. That system will go into place on June 6th of this year, at which point our pay and chase waiver for pharmacy will be handed back to the federal government. We were waiting until June to make sure that the best system available to the pharmacies so that there would be less problems in terms of the electronic exchange of information. We were satisfied that it would be occurring at that time. I'm not familiar with the numbers cited on the HCFA 64 that digital healthcare quoted. We would be willing to do more research in that, although obviously it can track recoveries. It can't really track the cost avoidance figures, which are substantial because, as I mentioned, when the clients apply for the Oregon Health Plan, they cite who their other carriers are. And at times when information comes to us about other carriers or other insurers, maybe a work comp injury, we then put that information on the file and in some cases do have to do some recoveries. The last point I'd like to make, and it's just a clarification, we could do more research, is in fact they were quite correct. CMS does reimburse us at a higher rate for information systems, computer-based work. However, they're very clear that it has to be the state's and the Fed's own work, meaning that whatever system you're using or building is something that's theirs or, in the case of the state and federal, ours alone. So oftentimes work with another carrier or group wouldn't be reimbursed at that rate, but that's something that we could investigate.
Okay. So you're saying that federal reimbursement is only strictly for state...
Right, for systems that the federal government would in fact own, receive that highest reimbursement rate for information systems.
Okay. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. What about the private carriers then who plug into that system? Can they plug into that system?
Chair Fisher, Senator Morissette, I'm not exactly certain how that will work. I know, for example, with the managed care plans we contract with, they can certainly have a contract with digital health care or other carriers who provide that information. And as they mentioned, I believe Providence was, in fact, either using one or exploring one. And I believe several of our other carriers do the same. It's something that they subscribe to because they feel it's a benefit to their system.
Senator Morissette. What about six other states that were mentioned? Are you...
Chair Fisher, Senator Morissette, I'm not familiar with that information. We have talked to several carriers similar to Digital in the past, and at that point when we had asked at least the one we had worked with more recently to get information about other Medicaid programs, they weren't able to provide us anything very concrete. So we'd be more than happy to review the information Digital provided and look into it.
Okay.
If the state sets up the program, then that would facilitate private carriers from hooking up to the program, would it? Or would it make any... Okay, if the state did not sign up for the program, would private carriers be able to do it on their own?
Chair Fisher, Senator Morissette, it's my understanding that private carriers could sign up with these kind of programs on their own. Whether or not a small physician's office, you know, may find that cost effective is probably another question.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is the connection between the state signing up for the program and the benefit to private carriers because the state signed up for the program is what I'm trying to arrive at.
Chair Fisher, Senator Morissette, we'd be more than happy to investigate that if you're interested. How it might work if the state were to be involved and make it available to private providers?
Well, I was thinking in terms of the state working with the private providers for the cost of setting up the program is what I was getting at.
I'm sure we'd be willing to look into it if that's here.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Lopez, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Employment and Financial Benefits in the Department of Human Services. We serve seniors and people with disabilities. We had come today prepared to talk about the 865 in its previous format and didn't come prepared to talk about the amendments. But in hearing the presentation, I did want to share with the committee that we do, as a condition of eligibility, identify when any individual does have a third-party resource involved, and that is coded on our system so that they are the first payer and that the state of Oregon is the second payer. I do understand we have pay and chase on our pharmacy only, and then that is ending on June 6th, as Joan said. But we would certainly be willing to do more analysis on the budget impacts. We just hadn't had time to do that. We saw the bill when we came in.
You're going to do your automated or your computerized billing starting June 6th. How many sources are you going to be examining?
Chair Fisher, I would have to go back and ask how many separate vendors there are on the system that would link up with pharmacy, and we can certainly do that. It would send out the claim to any insurer listed on our system at the current time.
So this is pharmacy only?
For pharmacy only. That's the waiver that we have from the federal government to do pay and chase right now for pharmacy.
Why only pharmacy?
Chair Fisher, it's my understanding that that was the only area in which we felt we needed a pay and chase waiver, because at the time it was very difficult for pharmacists to bill another carrier and then wait for it to come back. So it was a kind of an automation issue at the pharmacies. That was my understanding of it anyway. It's before my time.
Is that for the $12 million that was collected? Came from in the last report that I got of the state's recoveries?
Chair Fisher, if it said pay and chase, cost of waiver, that may in fact be the amount. It sounds familiar, but I can't quite do it from memory, but I think you might be right.
Thank you very much.
Quite welcome.
Would you, by the way, would you be able to get that figure of how much you have been?
The amount for the pay and chase?
Yes.
Yes, certainly.
Thank you very much. John Mangus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, John Mangus, Department of Veterans Affairs. I'll be real quick. Senate Bill 865, as originally written, I originally came over here to say I disagreed with that because I thought it was pretty blatant the way it discriminated against veterans as a class. The dash two amendments, although I'm not necessarily sure I understand all of that, and I understand maybe there's going to be a dash three amendment coming along from some of the conversation earlier. But
I'm
I'm
sure there may be more than just a dash three, because we've had some contact with some of the House members that have not got back to us with information that they want yet. And this other amendment, I believe, comes from the same group that dash three potentially comes from the same group that we work with to do the dash two.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I guess I would be, my concern would be is if there was a system where a claim was submitted for payment and then on a system it popped up that this individual is a veteran and therefore the Department of Veterans Affairs, U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, you know, is the provider of, you know, first payer or second payer. That could cause, you know, a lot of confusion along the line because all veterans, including you, are entitled to health care through the Department of Veterans Affairs. Unfortunately, we're all prioritized, and it could be years before you could get into the system as opposed to another person.
No.
And should a person require medical care and be eligible for the state health care program, I would hate to see them being basically jacked around because the VA should be providing this and not the state, you know, when in fact he can't get into the federal system. What Jacqueline and Jeff Hill were talking about up here was a program that they've been working on for some time, as have others, where they take individual senior, generally aged veterans, and a lot of these individuals don't realize they're entitled to VA benefits just based on their military service during a wartime period, and they have low income and they're disabled, and they are receiving income benefits through senior and disabled services. That person could possibly qualify for benefits paid by the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they've worked diligently to try to get these people off the state system over onto the federal system, which saves the state money and generally improves the benefit to that individual. But it does take a period of time, not always, but in a lot of cases, to get that benefit through the adjudication process. But overall, it's beneficial to the state of Oregon and to the individual veteran. But if they do get a retroactive check, that money is non-assignable and non-attachable by anybody. That's in Title 38 U.S. Code.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have. I was just concerned for vets on 865.
Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. John, so is it your sense that the pilot program is a good investment for us?
I guess, Senator Fisher, Senator Brown, I think it has been. I think it was cut short before it could prove its total value. But you have to. Money's been kind of scarce, things like this cost a little bit more money. But the general fund money that I receive for veterans benefits, such as the county service officers, the $10,000 they were talking about, the way that works, it's a county can apply for benefits 75% of their budget up to a maximum of $12,500, and that was established in 1981. It has not changed. Unfortunately, the money we receive for that pot up to $12,000 has dwindled now to $10,000. Our general fund is now 2% less than we received in 1989-91, where the rest of the state general fund has increased 139%. So we haven't been on the fast track for receiving funds, you know, to supplement the counties in that. And that's where they came back to get their supplemental or the program through DHS to work with. And I think it was working fine. People just don't know what they're entitled to, no matter how much publicity you put out. It's just you need people like Jeff and Multnomah County. They worked hard to make that program successful.
Mr. Chair, I thought I heard one of the gentlemen say that it took him 14 years to get his veteran benefits. Is that I mean, how difficult could it be?
Well, I'll tell you. 14 years is kind of out of line. Well, we go back all the time and we establish claims for World War II veterans, and we have done it for World War I veterans. So there you're talking 60 years or maybe longer. But as a rule, if you filed a claim today, it would probably take you close to a year to get it through unless it was just a snap claim, to get it through the adjudication process at the VA regional office in Portland, because of the backlog and then getting all the records together. And there's a lot of things that have happened. Vietnam vets, I guess we were labeled as whiners ever since we got back, but the fact is, you know, we started yelling and screaming about Agent Orange in the late 60s, and everybody, including the Department of Defense, the White House, the Congress, everybody denied that that would harm anybody. Now there's a litany of events that have happened that cause prostate cancer, diabetes type 2, leukemia, chloracne, I mean, that are accepted as a result of Agent Orange. Mm-hmm. We can go back. A person comes in, has prostate cancer now, and he served in country in Vietnam. We can establish service connection like that. Well, it should have been established years ago, but, you know, it's just... it's a complicated system, and there's no better satisfaction in the world, as I'm sure Jeff can say, is winning a claim like that for somebody.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Yeah, sure.
So the issue is not so much that they were a veteran and did in fact serve, but that the health issues that they are suffering were a result of war or service injury. That's the cause and effect. That's the difficulty.
Yeah, and there's two types of benefits. Service connected, where it was incurred in or aggravated by your military service, so it could be injury or disease. And then there's a gratuitous type benefit called pension, whereas if you served 90 days during a wartime period and had an honorable service and you have limited income and you're disabled from car wreck, fall down a mountain, or whatever, you can apply for pension if you meet these other income and disability requirements. And that's where the benefit has been to some of these counties, because these people don't realize they're entitled to that. Jeff and his crew round them up, get them on pension, get them off welfare, and it's a win-win for everybody.
Great. Thank you.
John, is there any rule of thumb or way that a company that handled the billings like were presented to us could make some kind of a determination as to the veterans service eligibility?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe the VA will release information on the eligibility of each of its individual veterans. I'm in Category 1 and to the VA, but I'm rated for two separate disabilities, but I can go to the VA and get treatment for any other disability, but I can't go to my private doctor for those disabilities unless I get pre-authorization. What information they would release to, say, digital health care regarding me, I don't know. Each disability has a code. They may release that. You know, they mentioned HIPAA, you know, several times. HIPAA comes into play here in a couple of days, one portion of it. I don't think anybody understands it, least of all Congress, because, you know, we turned down a request from Senator Wyden for information the other day based on HIPAA. He wasn't entitled to it, and he came right out of the chair. So, you know, it's what can they release, what can't they release? I mean, your health information is protected now to a greater extent than it ever has been in the past. How that would work with the VA, I don't know. The VA has always been very protective of information on you as a veteran. If they have it in their records, generally, they're very tight-lipped about that, as well they should be. I don't know. I was just concerned that, you know, just, you know, because you're a vet, you're a blanket no. And I wouldn't want to see a guy denied health care because, well, you should go to the VA, and then it takes you 18 months to access the system and you die. You know.
Or it takes 18 months to sort out the fact that the VA won't pay for it and has to go back to the original payer, and somebody hasn't got their money up until that length of time.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've had people that are service-connected for a heart attack or for a heart condition, have a heart attack, and they can't get to a VA hospital, so say they end up in a Staten hospital. They recover, you know, to the extent they can be moved, so they're transported to Portland. Well, there's a bill at the Staten Hospital. Somebody has to pay. And that can take months and months and maybe years to get the VA to pay that piece of the cost of that care, even though he was service-connected for it. The feds are a great system to deal with, believe me.
Some people say that about Oregon.
Yeah, we're a wonderful state. Been here all my life.
Thank you very much, John. Appreciate the information. And again, I would invite you to, if you have any knowledge that you can transmit to us concerning future amendments or things that we're dealing with here, well, we'd certainly appreciate having that expertise. Thank you. Tom Holt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I'd like to speak just briefly to the Dash 2 amendments, about which we have a minor concern. But just by way of background and explanation, we've had online adjudication of pharmacy claims for a number of years, and the reason why we've had pay and chase in pharmacy is simply because the pharmacy has to be able to rely on the accuracy of a claim when, once it's transmitted through the system, because we're often in Medicaid sending hundreds or even thousands of dollars worth of product out the door with the patient that have to be replaced in inventory, and it is very difficult, as Joan alluded to, for pharmacy to chase down another potential payer after they've already been told online that they have a good claim. We have supported OMAP's move to automate the process of finding other coverage for people in the Oregon Health Plan, and in fact we've been coordinating with OMAP on some training that's going to take place in the next month for pharmacies to deal with this. Our concern with the Dash 2 is simply that the proponents haven't taken into account the very significant presence of pharmacy in the Medicaid program. I notice on the list of folks who would be included in an advisory group to the department does not include pharmacy, and so our suggestion, if this amendment were to move forward, would be just to add a representative of the pharmacy community to that list so that there are no unintended consequences with whatever is done in this new system that might get in the way of actually what OMAP's already going to be doing in the pharmacy arena. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Have a member interrogating another member. Apparently, Tom, we don't have any questions. So thank you much for your testimony, and I've asked my administrator to make a note of the fact that pharmacy was not included, and that should be easy enough to...
Yeah, we'll be happy to work with you either on an amendment here or to work on the House side to fix it over there, whatever your preference is.
Well, we'll try to do as much as we can with it here before we send it over, because their time is precious, too. So,
thank you, sir.
I wonder if I could have Mr. Gard come up again. the testimony has brought up a couple of questions, at least to my mind, and I thought while we had you here, I said guard grad, I apologize for that.
Close enough. Chairman Fisher, Senators?
If we don't butcher it any worse than that, we won't be too bad. Yeah, I was wondering here now, since we've got the testimony about this 90% funding and 75% funding, that they're saying that it has, it's only relative to fully state-run programs, not to combined programs, or not covering the portion that would be maybe to an outside group that was working with the state. Have you had experience with that yet, or...
Chairman Fisher, no, I haven't, and I'd be glad to do the research on that. It was initially a question from you that had me look into that. The people at Digital Healthcare, who I have spoken to, have assured me that the money is available and that it can be done, but I'd like to defer that question until I can get you a better answer.
All right. Also, I had... how do you propose to bill? I think you saw the concern that the VA folks had that because with the disparity of military personnel that has gone on, and I guess now we're pretty well absolved of anybody from World War One, but so basically we're just dealing with World War Two to the present. And yet there's apparently a lot of veterans that either haven't got to the age level where they get benefits or to the stage in their finances where they get benefits. Many different things would go. How do you, in other words, if you're sending bills to the appropriate payer first off, how do you recognize veterans that should be able to get benefits and maybe aren't, as adverse to those that... that might look like they should but can't?
Chairman Fisher, thank you for asking that question. It's a complicated way of saying it, but very simply, the VA or the state of Oregon or Regents Blue Shield would put their data into our computer system as to their eligibility and warrant that data for the period of time that they put that person in there, such as yourself. And if you went in and filed a claim or went into a doctor's office, that doctor would put in your name and information, pull up who is primary and who is secondary. If you don't currently have veterans benefits, if the Veterans Administration is not currently showing you on their eligibility list, it would show the other insurance companies in primary, secondary order as to who does have it. If that veteran does have veterans coverage and other coverage, it would come up showing, say, Regents Blue Shield is primary, veterans secondary, and on down the line. And at that point, that patient and that doctor would know what benefits were going to be paid by which primary secondary company and be able to make the decision at the time of care as to how to go forward. In other words, if he went into a doctor and said, I want to get this particular situation taken care of, they pulled up his, or they didn't have our system, he went ahead and did it, then that doctor would have a potential rescission or an unpaid bill, or he'd have to go track down that veteran to pay the claim himself, versus having that information on hand at the time of service. The veteran would know what is available to him at that point of time. That doctor would know what he is able to perform and what that veteran is eligible for, and that would go for other patients besides veterans, whether they be on Medicaid and Regents Blue Shield or whatever carrier they might be with.
I guess it bothered me a little bit that the federal government would see fit to send money back to somebody that had not paid it and then make it to the point where it could not be collected by the people that had paid it when they had paid it, recognizing by the federal government paid it in error or unnecessarily. And I guess that doesn't set too well with me.
I guess, Senator, Chairman Fisher, I didn't follow you on that.
Well, the monies, when these cases are decided and the veterans take someone on after this year's time, after they filed, from the date of filing, they send a check to the veteran for the amount of money that has been spent on his care. He does not have to then send it to the people that have actually paid it, such as the state or some private insurance company or something like that, if it was available. And I guess that bothers me, because in a way they seem to me to be an accomplice to a certain amount of theft in that particular situation. And to me, that's it's not exactly fair. It's a rough enough go being involved in the state stuff, let alone have the federal government do that. I'm quite sure if the federal government had something coming from somebody and we said, oh, well, we'll pay it to them, and our law says you can't get it, I think they'd override us in a pretty quick hurry.
They'd find a way. Chairman Fisher, also I'd like to make note that Digital Healthcare has met with the Veterans Affair on the federal level. They are very interested in discussing rolling out a pilot program in the near future. We are not sure whether they're going to roll out the pilot program before or after we testify on, I think it was May 7th. Thank you. We've found a very receptive ear with the Veterans Affairs Committee.
So in your estimation, then, in order for us to actually find out who has veterans benefits and stuff, we need to continue with a program such as was outlined by Jacqueline Zimmer Jones and Mr. Hull, that have been taking place up in Washington counties, whereby they're actively going out and working with people to get them on their and the veterans list or work with them to get them qualified for their veterans benefits, which is a rather lengthy process, because you would not be able to spot that particular person and say, no, we shouldn't pay this, because that person would have access to benefits. You would only have the list of accepted. So basically the problem that I was seeing, where someone does have those benefits, you would not be able to avoid paying for those and have them go get it from the Veterans Administration. And that was something that I was hoping that maybe that was available in this program.
Well, I mean, as I said, is
do everything.
Yeah, Chairman Fisher. Well, we will try. As I said, we are a switchboard to make sure the proper claim gets to the proper place, preemptive to billing. So that we know at time of service, or you know at time of service, who that bill belongs to. If that person has been put on VA benefits, then that claim should be adjudicated by the VA. If he's not on VA, then we will find out the primacy with all 4,000 payers in the country, whether they have put their data into our servers or not. Because with HIPAA was brought up, and HIPAA will allow us, without delay, and this is under HIPAA 1175, without a insurer, and the state of Oregon is an insurer, as is the VA, cannot delay nor deny the request for information on a standardized format. And that is what HIPAA is allowing us to do. It will not give us access to deep, detailed records. It will merely say, this person was insured on this date, and these are their benefits available. This company's primary, this company's secondary, this state, so on and so forth. We cannot cure everything, but we will guarantee that Medicaid only gets the bills that they are responsible for.
That was all the questions that I had. Did anyone else have any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Grad. We appreciate you and Mr. Eagles and Mr. Rutt coming up and working with us on this. And we will continue to pursue this and see how far we can take it anyway. And it's certainly a subject that I think needs to be brought up in a time when every one of us is scratching every way we can to make our dollar go as far as possible. So really, I do appreciate it. I might say that I guess the thing that got me started on this more than anything else was a situation that I knew of down in Roseburg, where somebody had been on the Oregon Health Plan for years when obviously they had access to veterans benefits, but perhaps it had been a little bit more of a hassle to them than getting on the Oregon Health Plan. And then you find out that basically we furnished things that the VA hospital would have and should have done for quite a few years, and especially in a time like this. Now, I don't think that we can afford to bail out the federal government without making every effort we can to help folks get the things that they've been entitled to by the federal government. So it's probably not going to be a real easy process, and I'm sure we're going to need to proceed and pursue a little bit of what the folks from Washington County were talking about, too. So we may wind up with more than one bill out of this thing. Who knows? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And was there anyone else that wished to give testimony that didn't get a chance to sign up? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 865 and adjourn our committee.